Okay, and Jeff Goldman is here.
Yep.
All right, and were you speaking on both, Mr. Goldman, or just one? Dead Man's Statute. Okay, all right. Now, aside from the people that I've read, is there anybody else here wants to speak on either one of these rules petitions? Okay, then we will proceed. Attorney Southwick, are you or Attorney Schreiner going to be the kickoff? You are. Okay, very good. Please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm April Southwick. I'm the attorney for the Wisconsin Judicial Council. And I'm going to begin by briefly summarizing the study, drafting, and vetting process that the council undertook to bring these two petitions here before you today. And then my colleague, Attorney Tom Schreiner, is going to talk a little bit about the substance of the proposed amendments. Petition 1601 and 1602 are part of a series of recommendations. They're the product of a multi-year study of the Wisconsin Rules of Evidence that has been conducted by the Judicial Council. This complex project began back in 2009 when Marquette University Law School professor Dan Blinka attended a council meeting and gave us a presentation highlighting changes that he felt would improve Wisconsin's evidentiary rules. He explained that in formulating his recommendations, he sought input from over 100 circuit court judges. Professor Blinka noted that the evidentiary rules have not undergone a comprehensive review since their adoption in the early 1970s. He suggested that the council conduct a study and recommend amendments to basically accomplish three basic things: to codify Wisconsin case law, to correct deficient rules, and to fill in some gaps in the rules. The Judicial Council tasked its Evidence and Civil Procedure Committee with the creation of a work plan to undertake this very large project. The committee recommended 15 basic rules or topics for study on this project. And during the course of its work on this, three of those topics were removed and designated for individual study and recommendation. Those three areas included spoliation of evidence, the expert witness privilege under the Ault case, and Rule 502 of the Federal Rules of Evidence addressing inadvertent disclosure. The council has already completed its work on inadvertent disclosure of privileged information. As many of you will recall, that resulted in an amendment to three rules that this court approved back, and it was effective January 1st of 2013. The council is continuing its study of spoliation and the expert witness privilege. So hopefully in the near future, we will have two more recommendations that will come from this project. We are nearing completion. Of the remaining 12 rules that were on the council's work plan, the council ultimately recommended changes in six areas, and with regard to the other six, found no evidence of problems or confusion surrounding their application, or concluded that there was not an appropriate amendment that they felt would adequately resolve difficulties with application of the rule. In the areas where it found that no textual change would help, often the recommendation was increased continuing legal education or increased judicial education. And those concerns were circulated to the Office of Judicial Education or to the State Bar or, in some instances, the Department of Justice if they were responsible for providing education for prosecutors or other attorneys or legal officials around the state. The study of these evidentiary rules has been quite thorough. The committee conducted its review one rule at a time, and they considered relevant Wisconsin case law applying the rule, paying particular attention to confusion or difficulty that resulted in that application. They reviewed many appellate cases, looking for areas that seemed to be recurring problems or recurring areas of confusion. They also spent quite a bit of time looking at any corresponding federal rules that may exist, and looking at applicable federal case law. Because many of Wisconsin's rules are based on the federal model, and the federal model has undergone amendments over the years where our Wisconsin rules may not have, they look to see if the federal rules have significantly diverged from their Wisconsin counterparts. The committee also sought input from judges and practitioners, paying close attention to the actual practice being used with regard to these rules. if actual practice and what was occurring in the courtrooms did not line up with the text of the rule, the committee looked at how they might be able to bring those two more closely in line. Ultimately, the committee felt very strongly that a new attorney or a new judge ought to be able to read the rule and have a pretty good understanding of how to use it. So if what was actually happening in the courtroom was not in line with simply reading the text of the rule, then that was a red flag that perhaps something ought to be done with that provision. The committee spent a minimum of several months on each rule. Some of these rules, the study took over a year to conclude.
Yeah, but the modifications are very small.
That is correct, Justice, and that is deliberate. Another factor that weighed heavily in the committee's consideration was to not upend the apple cart. They did not want to cause confusion or cause current existing law to become unsettled. So the committee was careful to consider very modest recommendations that would remain consistent with actual practice and current case law.
But the other thing that isn't done, and we'll have to figure out which one it is since I read them all together, you make reference to the changes in the federal rules and federal advisory comments, and then you don't put in the federal advisory comment. And to the extent you force a lawyer to go outside of the comments and then find the federal advisory comment, I don't think that's very good practice. Now, do you remember which one that was?
I do. I believe that was character for truthfulness.
It's probably 1602 because this one is a delete total. That were, if you're talking about 1601, I know you're talking generally now. But
right.
So when we look at that, the other thing that runs throughout this that I was somewhat interested in is, although it becomes effective on January 1 or July 1, you don't say to what cases it applies. So does the dead man's statute apply to a case that was brought today?
That's a very interesting question.
I'll say.
And actually, I did go back and look at the court's order from when it adopted the rule in the
70s. You did that, and you have it in your petition for rulemaking cover sheet. And you say, when the court previously adopted the rules of evidence, is that the first one that we're talking about?
Yes.
And 59 was second?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay. The new rules apply to pending actions, quote, except to the extent that in the opinion of the trial court, their application to a particular action or proceeding then pending would not be feasible or would work in justice, in which event the former rule applies, dated June 5. And we've used that language more recently in a new rule. But the rules you present today are silent on this issue. I don't think that's good.
Noted.
Well, no, it's not okay. What do you want to do?
Oh, I think the court should take the same action and include that suggested language in the order regarding
these
rules.
In both 1601 and in 1602.
Yes, Justice. I think that ultimately there could be the case where the argument could be made that it would be unfair to apply the new rules in a particular case. So the circuit court judge ought to have some amount of authority or discretion to make that decision.
Say this is pleading in practice and that it doesn't affect the substance, but, well, I don't know about the dead man statute.
You would not be the only one who feels that way.
Yeah. Well, they may not know either, but I want an answer.
The Judicial Council's conclusion, and it reached this conclusion unanimously, was that the dead man statute is a procedural rule and that the court is the appropriate body to consider amendments or changes with regard to that rule.
So you think this is not substantive? It doesn't have to go to the legislature?
Correct.
I think that's an issue. It's one, in my mind, that I resolve consistent with apparently what the Judicial Council
advances, in part because if we giveth, we can taketh away. There's a certain symmetry to it all, right? And we gave and we can take away. But in looking at the text of the statute, an argument can be made that there it isn't merely procedural, it involves substance too. So should we you indicated in response to the prior question that others think it's substantive. What's that argument as to why it is substantive?
I actually do not have a good grasp on the reason why others feel it's substantive. The concern that has largely been expressed is the fact that it's a legislatively created statute. It ought to be left to the legislature to take action on it. In response to that, the Judicial Council has advocated that the legislature has had ample opportunity to take action on it. It's a rule regarding competency. This court has a long history of passing, amending, adopting rules regarding competency, and that it should, in fact, take action on this one.
Help me with the history. If I recall, the Dead Man Statute comes from 1858 or something like that, and envisioned
the
common law. This is where I am unsure. I read the stuff, but I might have skipped it over it. Didn't we in 1973 make it part of the rules of evidence?
To my knowledge, from going back and reviewing the petition, the Dead Man Statute was part of the Judicial Council's recommendation for repeal when the rules of evidence were adopted, and the court simply didn't act on that provision at all.
There was protest. The probate section of the state bar said, you dastn't do that. So that's why I started my comment with what we giveth, we, as the court, we can take away. And we gave it in 1973 by making it part of the rules of evidence, as I saw it, which really started in 1858.
And you raise a good point as to the state bar protesting it, and ultimately what they did was ask to form their own committee and recommend an amendment to it, which they did, and it gained no traction. And then they later, and not too long after that, kind of reversed course and did support the repeal of it. So there has not been, even historically, strong support for this rule.
This seems to be the only part of these rule petitions that have raised any question. You've got, three people here, all appearing on the Dead Man Statute, so it's not quite a dead issue.
And it's actually quite interesting because as the council was going through the drafting process, there was not significant concern, or there was not concern at all, actually, to be completely accurate about it. There was no concern expressed on either the Evidence and Civil Procedure Committee or from the council itself regarding the recommendation to repeal. The real question was how to move forward with that recommendation. And once the recommendation was made, the Judicial Council unanimously supported bringing all of these recommendations here before this court.
My recollection in reading the materials is the ABA has some group that supports getting rid of the Dead Man Statute. The Uniform Law Commission, which usually or often deals with legislative action, has recommended getting rid of Dead Man Statutes also.
And quite a number of state Supreme Courts have repealed their Dead Man Statutes.
So that's what I was going to tell you. If you'll let it live through its normal lifespan, it would be destroyed up here. If not totally, at least partially destroyed in opinions of this court.
Yes.
My understanding of the Deadman statute is the question of the competency of testimony with respect to a transaction with a deceased person.
I can't hear you.
My understanding of the concern with the Deadman statute is when you provide testimony of a transaction with someone who is deceased, there's no one to rebut that testimony. And the purpose of the statute was to prevent that from coming in unless there are independent indicia of reliability. Repealing that and creating a bias rule, how do we know if that's going to be a sufficient protection against the evils that the Deadman statute was meant to protect against?
Well, I think in that regard, we can certainly look to the success that other states have had. An overwhelming number of states have either already repealed their Deadman statutes or have gone this direction using evidence of bias in lieu of flat-out barring testimony.
Now, there are several states that have done that, as you know, but how do we measure their success with it? Do we have any way of measuring the reliability of results obtained in trials under that regime?
I believe we do. One thing that certainly is a factor that the Judicial Council weighs is they will look at the date that the state made that change and look at whether or not they have subsequently amended it or went back to the way the laws previously were, because the presumption is that if you have a law in place for 10, 15, 20 years and it's not working, you would take action to change it. And so we presume that if they enact a change and they keep it, especially if they keep it for several decades, it's working.
Is there any ability to look at the appellate record and see if these kinds of issues are being appealed more often and what kind of arguments are being made in those appeals to determine whether there are any problems with the way that this regime works?
Certainly. Now, are you speaking to Wisconsin appellate cases or other states?
Other states. Just to get a sense. I mean, I put my cards on the table. This seems to make sense to me. To make these changes, but I'd like to have some measure of assurance that this is not going to create appellate issues, that this is not going to invite litigation over the potential ill effects of changing the way that we deal with this kind of testimony. So I'm just wondering if in your research you've come across any additional appellate advocacy, appellate activity on this kind of issue in the other states that have adopted this kind of regime?
Actually, the other state that the committee worked or looked most closely at would have been Missouri. Missouri amended their dead man statute off the top of my head, I believe it was around about 1985. And what they did, they retained the dead man statute, but they put something that's very similar to the bias rule that we have proposed within the text of the dead man statute, so that they can allow the testimony, but then evidence of bias or interest can also be introduced. And the committee came very close to making a recommendation to model our rules on that, because in their review of what Missouri had done, it appeared to be working very well. The concern that the committee had ultimately was that because Wisconsin already permits the use of bias and interest within case law, it's part of Wisconsin common law, that if we put that text only within the dead man statute, that could cause confusion. People may stop and say, why is that here? Does that mean we can no longer use this for other purposes? Is our use of bias limited now in some way to only cases involving dead man statute issues? So the recommendation was, while it appeared that things were working well under that model in Missouri, it would be better to do a bias rule as a standalone so that it was clear that it could be used in multiple applications.
We're going to get to bias in 1602, will we?
Yes. And actually, Attorney Schreiner will be talking a little bit more about the substance as well. So you will definitely have another crack at asking questions in this area.
What effect does this have as present in the Dead Man Statute and as revised on instructions that do not resuscitate? Are you familiar with that?
I am, but I can honestly say I have not considered that, and you were the first one to raise that question. I don't know.
Now, there are many things that could be in a medical power of attorney that someone signed that might be in conflict with this.
They put DNR at the end of a hospital bed if there's a instructions to do not resuscitate, which is adhered to.
Well, the other area I wanted to touch on is the vetting process. Once the council approved this entire recommendation, they then sought input from attorneys, judges, and other potentially interested parties by widely circulating the proposed changes that are before you today. The council provided a 60-day comment period for parties to provide feedback. As part of that comment period, the State Bar also published an article on the proposed changes, as well as publishing the text of the changes, and including a notice to its membership that the council was inviting feedback and public comment.
But the Board of Governors took no position, am I right?
You're correct.
Why?
Unfortunately, the Board of Governors meeting was the same day as the Judicial Council meeting, so I was unable to attend. Which means I was also unable to present on the petition or be there to respond to questions. Mm-hmm. So I actually cannot say what the...
I didn't check the minutes, but we can do that, of the Board of Governors.
Yeah, I typically personally attend those meetings to respond to questions, but with the conflict, mm-hmm. I couldn't do it in this instance. But during the 60-day comment period that the Judicial Council had, we received no negative feedback on any of these proposed changes, received several notes of positive feedback in support of them, and we did receive some questions from the Committee of Chief Judges, and that resulted in the Council going back to the drafting table and making some amendments to the note accompanying 90609, impeachment by prior conviction. The next step in the project that's before you today was presenting this petition, ultimately recommending the amendment of three evidentiary rules, the repeal of the Dead Man Statute, the repeal of a very little used and little even known about statute regarding privilege between students and deans of students and school psychologists, and the creation of a bias rule.
I can say I've never seen this dean's statute my memory prior to today.
Justice Bradley, you would be surprised to hear that most school officials and even attorneys that represent school groups were unaware of this provision as well. And when we met with different groups seeking input on what we should do with this rule, their initial comment was, well, perhaps we should just amend it because it's very confusing. There are a lot of internal conflicts within the rule itself. And then after they thought more about it, their response was, you need to repeal this. This is just a trap for the unwary. This is just going to get people in trouble.
I thought that we couldn't create privileges, and that was for the legislature.
This really isn't, either, although it's titled a privilege, it really isn't a privilege. It's more of a rule of confidentiality, and it actually runs... It conflicts quite a bit with the physician-patient privilege. And so it's just a statute hanging out there that could potentially cause confusion.
Could you expound on the conflict you just mentioned? How does it conflict with the physician-patient privilege in your mind?
The requirements for this rule to apply and the requirements for the physician-patient privilege to apply don't line up. The licensing provisions for the physician-patient privilege are different than the licensing provisions for some school psychologists. So it's going to, potentially this rule could apply to some school psychologists, but not others.
But it also applies to deans, which would be outside of the physician-patient privilege. So we would be removing something, I think, substantive if we would repeal this. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Do you know what the genesis of this provision was?
No. I have tried to find some historical record for why this was adopted. I was able to find some early drafting records, but I have not been able to uncover anything to indicate the reason for the adoption of this. And as I said, we've contacted many school groups and also reached out to the university because, you know, it can apply at the college level as well. And no one supports this, and the general response that we've gotten is, we didn't even know that existed.
Well, if your comment to Justice Bradley is correct, that this does change a substantive matter, there really isn't anything we can do with it under pleadings and practice, correct? We're
no.
prohibited from changing substantive rights of any party.
I'm sorry, I wasn't clear on that. No, we do not feel that this is a substantive matter. We believe this is procedural as well.
Well, if someone has a special right under this particular statute and this right can be waived, why don't you think it's substantive?
We feel that it is in line with, well, not consistent with, but falling into the same category as other rules of privilege and confidentiality that this court has acted on previously in adopting the rules of evidence. And our biggest question was, why wasn't this addressed as part of the rules of evidence package? Because it was a fairly new provision at the time those were adopted, and we can't find any reference to it. We don't know if it fell through the cracks or if, because it was a new rule, mm-hmm. they just decided to give it some time to see what would happen before any action was taken.
Well, who adopted it?
The legislature.
So we are repealing a legislative adoption?
Yes. Consistent with a number of other provisions that were repealed.
Oh, yeah, we do it a lot.
Yeah.
I recognize that. We took over the state law library, which was a legislative enactment since 1848. We took that over. We've adopted a number of matters, or repealed a number of matters that were legislative.
Did the council consider amending the statute to remove its application to school psychologists? Because I grant you, it does conflict with 90504, but leaving in place the privilege or confidentiality aspects with respect to deans and students.
The council did consider amending this provision. Where the big concern came in was in the provision regarding testifying in criminal cases. And the council felt that, in particular, that was a very problematic provision. And felt that, one, this is not being used, and two, that provision leaves open the door for all kinds of confusion and problems, that the better road to take would be simply to repeal this.
And go ahead, please. I was going to flip back to the dead man statute for
okay,
a moment.
Well, I don't think it conflicts with the patient's privilege. You fall into that, you get that. Just because you don't fall into it doesn't mean you don't have any privilege. Attorney-client privilege doesn't fall into physician-patient privilege. That doesn't mean it conflicts. This is just a different privilege for a different set of people. I'm not sure what it means, and I don't know that it's ever been used, and I don't know that I agree with it. Here it is.
Well, that brings me back to why these rules are before you today. This court has a lot of experience adopting and amending evidentiary rules. As a result of previous work by this court, As this court has previously stated, it's the purpose of the court to limit itself strictly to procedural matters and to consider those matters with the sole purpose of ensuring that our procedural law may not be encumbered by useless or unfair rules which complicate and confuse the trial of cases or add to the expense of litigation. Updating Wisconsin's evidentiary rules fits squarely within that purpose, as does repealing antiquated or outdated rules. It was the council's determination that this is an example of one of those rules that falls into the category of potentially confusing or increasing the expense of litigation, and that it was antiquated and should be repealed.
I may have missed this question. If I did, I apologize. Do we always treat questions of privilege as an evidentiary rule?
I can't think of an example where we wouldn't.
Okay. Just to distinguish it from substance that we would, a substantive right that we would not be able to pass.
Correct. Arguably, the law is that the court cannot create any new privileges. And without having research in front of me on that, that's the rule of thumb that we can't. I could pull up the research shortly, but I don't have it in front of me. So if we cannot create new privileges, an argument can be advanced that we shouldn't get rid of privileges either. You seem to do it, try to, your response to that kind of an argument is that this is not really a privilege, as I hear the argument. And tell me why this is not really a privilege.
Well, I think comparing the text of this provision to the text of what we commonly understand to be rules of privilege, the two just don't match. This really reads more as a confidentiality rule. It does have a bit of a mixture of the privilege element when it's addressing being able to testify and that kind of
waived. How would you distinguish between a privilege and a statute conferring confidentiality on a conversation?
Basically, who has the duty and who can waive it, and in this particular case, an example would be find the text of it. The fact that the prohibition does not extend to a criminal case where a dean has been subpoenaed to testify, that's clearly not consistent. You're just exempting a whole category. That's clearly not consistent with a privilege rule. That's actually not even very consistent with a rule of confidentiality. And it's also very curious that the exceptions only apply to deans, that the school psychologists are kind of left hanging. It's a very odd, very inconsistent rule.
Well, your memo that accompanies the petition, I think I've got it right, says that you considered the effect of the repeal on Chapter 118. So what is the effect of 118, which has confidentiality proof? I didn't check it. Provision.
Honestly, off the top of my head, I am drawing a blank on the Chapter 118 provision. It was one of the provisions that the school psychologist referenced, and so the committee looked at it to see if it would raise any problems, and concluded that it would not. But now, off the top of my head, I'm blanking on what the provision said.
Well, it doesn't refer to a particular provision, so I'm going to have a hard time finding it. There may be something in here about confidentiality for school operations.
It could be confidentiality, or it could also be required reporting. They consider that as well.
That's right, and I just don't know. We'll have to check that. And the commissioner's memo made no reference to that, at least that I can remember, so we'll have to look at that.
Does anyone have any additional questions on the study, drafting, and vetting process?
No, I thought that you set it out very well in your, not only did you set it out very well, but you used a very good process, of course, which the Judicial Council invariably does, of getting good drafts to begin with and then vetting it through many, many different interested groups, and that was especially clear as to the issues when it came to impeachment by other crimes, where you had a lot of case law, not necessarily consistent, and it's, I don't want to say an everyday occurrence in every court in this state, but it may very well be close to that. And that the chief judges obviously had some difficulties with that. I do read their minutes, so I was aware of that. And I read your minutes. I don't read the Board of Governors' minutes all the time, but and when I do, I'm not sure I remember them all because they're quite voluminous. But that's what comes up on this. Why didn't they comment at all? But anyhow, it that may very well be that this is a matter of confidentiality, that it's in Chapter 118. But your process is very good. That doesn't necessarily, process is very important. Chances of doing well with a good process increases. It doesn't necessarily mean that when another set of eyes looks at it, sees something else, which is happening to you right now.
Understood, Your Honor.
Very, very sympathetic.
Impeachment by prior conviction raised special challenges,
sure,
because we had so many diverse opinions about
right.
what ought to be done with that rule, and we spent a lot of time working with stakeholders
yep.
to reach consensus on that.
Because a lot of people have had experience and different experiences and therefore have different opinions, so I recognize that. So I think the vetting process is very good. I think that you have recognized that there are just issues here, and resolution has to be made of these issues.
Right.
Are the repeal of the two dead man statutes tied to our acceptance of the enactment of 90616, or are they totally separate considerations?
What's 90616?
That's where
that's
they create
the
bias of a witness, right? It's on page 4 of the staff memo.
I would say those are completely separate.
Completely
issues.
Separate.
Yeah.
They're separate, but they're tied together. That raises another question. We've had difficulties with what is bias? Explicit bias, implicit bias. There's a judicial code provision about judges, the members of clubs that are biased or stereotyped. I've forgotten the exact language, but I think that the court insisted on putting an invidious bias or invidious invidious discrimination, whatever the language was. So I noticed there's no definition of bias in there.
That is correct. The council's conclusion was that it would be...
You know it when you see it.
...sufficient to adopt a simple, straightforward rule that simply reflects common law in Wisconsin. We already have bias. It's something the courts are already dealing with, and they are already in a position to be able to apply this rule because it is consistent with current case law. Well, now, if you have no more questions about the process, Attorney Tom Schreiner will talk to you a little bit more about the substance.
I have one more question about process. It appears that the probate section has not weighed in on the repeal of the dead man statute, but back in 1973, they were opposed to its repeal when it was proposed as part of the adoption of the rules of evidence. Do you have an understanding as to why the probate section has not weighed in at this time?
I don't.
Thank you.
Like I said, we did send this to the state bar and ask that they distribute it to their sections and ask for feedback. The state bar published an article asking people to provide us feedback. And when I don't hear, I have no way of knowing why I didn't.
Thank you.
As a side note, this may be important, particularly for our new justices. Our appearance here today does not end the Judicial Council's work when we make recommendations. If the court chooses to adopt our recommendations, then the council works with the state bar. I write articles that they publish. I and my fellow council members also appear at continuing legal education courses to talk about the changes and educate folks. Basically, any invitation that we get to help with the education of these rule changes, to the extent possible, we accept it, and we take ownership for these recommendations and continue to try to make sure that the bench and bar understand the changes and how they work. Thank you.
Attorney Schreiner.
Good morning, Chief Justice. May it please the court. We probably didn't divide this up the right way. I don't know how we would have done it better. This is the way we did it the last time we came up together, and so we followed it. But let me, if I may, take up first the, I think it must be 1601, the amendments to 90107, 608, 609, and 616. Which nobody cares about, apparently, at least nobody showed up.
Well, attorneys care about it.
Well, they care about 885-16, I think.
Sorry. Mr. Schreiner, which one are you going to talk about, 1601 or 1602?
Two.
1602
first.
1602, I'm in the wrong order.
1601 is the dead man.
Okay,
no.
Fine.
Nice to go in order.
1602 first. I'll talk about both of them. We intentionally put these into two petitions because we knew that 885-16 and 17, 885-205, might raise questions with the court about whether what we're asking the court to do falls within its authority, both its inherent power to regulate procedure and practice, and the legislatively recognized exercise of that power of 751-12. 751-12 is an extraordinarily broad grant of power, as these things go, a recognition by the court or by the legislature that in regulating pleading practice and procedure in judicial proceedings, the court may actually repeal statutes. One doesn't see that very often. Now, the legislature has...
And the legislature can repeal or change a rule that this court adopts, and if you look at the history, you will see one thing by the legislature, another by the court, then the court again, then the legislature, et cetera.
There have been several of those. So it's a dynamic process, and obviously the court and the legislature owe each other a sense of respect. I think normally when the court decides to do something on pleading and practice, the legislature leaves them alone. Sometimes it doesn't.
That's under 751-12. It says
right.
It right there.
Right. And also the legislature recognizes the responsibility of the Judicial Council in 751-12-5 to act in an advisory committee to assist the court in performing its duties. So we broke these apart because of the awareness that the dead man statute and the whatever we want to call that other 885-205 rule might raise issues with the court.
Well, you have a memorandum. Where in the memorandum do you discuss this problem of substantive versus procedural? You've got it under in page 1011, but I don't see a discussion of this. You say evidence rules are generally procedural in nature, and courts have specifically ruled that rules of competency, such as dead man statutes, are procedural and not substantive law, citing Hortman versus Henderson. That's a federal case which says matters of competency of witnesses is to be determined in diversity actions under rules of evidence applied in courts of general jurisdiction of the state. Well, you know, what's rule of evidence for the feds may not be what we are, rule of evidence or rule of procedure under 751.12. Then you got a case that from Oregon that says it's procedural under Oregon law. And then you got an Alabama case which says abrogation of dead man statute by evidentiary rule was a permissible exercise of court's rulemaking authority. But none of that gives any reasoning as to why it's rulemaking and procedural. And so I'm not sure what we've got here.
Your Honor, the question of procedural versus substantive, of course, is a never-ending battle.
Right.
It has certainly been around at least since Erie in 1938 when the U.S. Supreme Court said that in diversity cases, federal courts would apply the substantive law of the state with the procedural laws of the federal courts.
But for purposes of Erie, what's procedural and substantive does not mean that's the same for purposes of 751.12.
No, it doesn't, but it's a good place to start. And it seems to me it's an understanding that most lawyers have. I mean, you get arguments that anything is substantive that could determine the outcome of the case or could affect the outcome of the case. That's not the meaning of substantive. You got to have a set of rules. That's what procedures are. And this Hortman case that you referred to, Judge Pell of the Seventh Circuit wrote it, is a case that involved people from Wisconsin who had gone to Mississippi for a funeral, and as they were driving home, got hit by a truck in Missouri. And three of the people in the car were killed, and the truck driver was sued. That lawsuit happened to be filed in Illinois. It was filed in a federal court in Illinois, and the federal court in Illinois did not follow Illinois' dead man statute, which would have precluded, talking about how antiquated the dead man statute can be, would have precluded the living truck driver from testifying to what he saw, because Illinois considers an auto accident a transaction. So that the only evidence there, or the only person who actually was there who could have testified to it, was barred from testifying. And the Seventh Circuit said, horrible law, but we have to apply it because it's procedural, because a rule of competency is a procedural rule. I think that's as good a place to draw a line as any. And certainly, we've got a body of law to look to if we want to know the difference between substance and procedure. But if I may, unless you don't want me to, I will start and just go through the individual rules in 1602. We start with 90107, the rule of completeness. The council suggests that that be amended to include not only writings, but oral statements?
You know, it doesn't say oral. It says recorded. It says oral in your in your memorandum. And when I read it, I thought recorded means tape recorded, computer this. To me, oral is not recorded.
Well, it's unrecorded.
It's unrecorded.
And the rule says unrecorded, so it's intended to extend to oral.
Is a written document recorded?
Sure. It's a record of the transaction.
But you add the unrecorded in this. That's not anywhere in the past rule, right? You still have got a recorded statement, but now you've also added an unrecorded statement.
Unrecorded meant to me, I don't read your memorandum, it meant oral. Why don't you just say oral? If it means oral, say oral.
I suppose something could be unrecorded in some other way. I mean, somebody communicates...
By hand signals.
By hand signals. I mean, sure, why not?
Fine.
American Sign Language.
Unrecorded and oral, and explain it in your comment.
Well, we picked up unrecorded because that's consistent with state versus Eugenio case, reflecting that court's conclusion that this actually already is the common law of Wisconsin.
Mr. Schreiner, the point about a rule.
Yes.
And the major point about a statute, too, doesn't always work this way, is that a lawyer or a non-lawyer, and there are a lot of administrators that look at, that are not lawyers, that look at the statutes and the texts, that they should understand it without having to go to other sources. That's the point of it. Now, it doesn't always work that way, and statutes and constitutions and rules get encrusted with interpretations. I understand that. But to the extent you can, you're supposed to draft rules so that you look at the rules and you know where it is and you don't have to go outside the rules. The next best thing you got with the rules is that you then have comments. So you put those two together and you ought to be able to go. And to tell and to say that it's you've got it from a case says when I read that rule, I've got to now figure out what case I have to go to and then go to the case. That's not really good.
We could say, I suppose, recorded or not.
Why don't you just say oral?
Writing
on the means.
We don't mean to change the existing law. We mean to expand it. We don't want to get rid of the ability to require the presentation of the full recorded statement to the extent that it's pertinent.
Then define recorded. I don't care how you do it, but you have to define recorded or define and define unrecorded and say what you mean. Because telling me to read the case means this is not drafted well enough.
I get your point, Your Honor.
The statute itself, as it's currently written, says when a writing or recorded statement or part thereof is introduced. Now, I can understand that focus. I've not had a problem with it. But how do you know when you've introduced only a part of a statement and it's not recorded? Who gets to say the whole thing was introduced or wasn't introduced? I don't quite understand how that would work.
It comes up, and that's where we put that language in at the end of the proposed rule to provide context or prevent distortion. It's not meant to open up the entire whatever went on that day. It's intended to focus the attention of the court on only so much as is necessary to make sense out of what the witness is testifying to. But it comes in by oral testimony, I assume.
Mr. Schreiner, can you give an example of when that would occur?
Well, I haven't thought of it, frankly, Your Honor, but it seems to me that it is an intent to deal with a statement that hasn't been reduced to writing in some form, but nevertheless is something that the witness wants to testify to that's pertinent to the proceeding in the court, where a witness says, defendant said thus and so, or Jones said thus and so, and the opponent wants to require relevant balance of the conversation to be introduced in evidence for context or to prevent distortion. And it really is an attempt to go beyond the requirement that it be in a writing to include oral. Mm-hmm. And I apologize that we have to use words. That's the problem.
You would rank oral. You had Professor Horak for legislation?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't hear the question.
Did you have Professor Horak for legislation?
No, I did not.
You should have taken the course.
I had Reed Dickerson. you may remember.
He was good, too, at Professor Hurst.
Justice Abrahamson and I went to the same law school, so we
knew. Right. And I remember Reed very well also.
Quite a character. He used to tell us about the Humpty Dumpty rule.
But check his book. I bet you'll find the concept that I have given you in his text.
You state a concept that I couldn't possibly argue with. And if I could be sure that in going to oral we weren't leaving something out that we would also want to get in.
I don't care about whether you just eliminate everything else and go to oral. What I care about is that you put in enough in the text that covers oral, sign language, and that gives the concept of what you're trying to do.
I think unrecorded does that, and Your Honor may disagree. Yeah.
Well, let's look at the dictionary definition of unrecorded and recorded, because not everyone will follow up with a C-site to State versus Eugenio. And I would urge you to stay with what I understand you to mean, and that is writing or oral, or some variation thereof. Because dictionary definitions of recorded and unrecorded include the following. You amend this to, you put when any part of a, you cross out writing or recorded, and I think you mean by recorded, you want to mean written, I think. But this is what recorded means in one dictionary. Set down or registered in a permanent form, especially on film or tape for reproduction. But I think you want written or writing there.
That's also set down in a permanent form.
Sure, but yeah. we the reader wants to know, I mean, I think you really mean written. I don't think you mean, digitally or on film or on tape. Then the definition of unrecorded in the dictionary. Not recorded on paper, tape, videotape, etc. So I think I get confused when I go to the dictionary and look at the dictionary definition, because I think what you're really trying to accomplish is to, I know what you're trying to accomplish, at least in part, is to get oral, to
right.
expand it from just
right.
written. And my best suggestion is to say it.
Well, I that's certainly the sense that the council has with it. My concern, Your Honor, is whenever we draft, we use words, we try to govern something that we can't conceive right now.
Sure,
and I don't
but
know
these
what,
are ordinary dictionary definitions.
I don't know. Dictionaries, though, follow usage, and so eventually it'll be in the dictionary. My concern is I don't know in 5 years what the form of recording is going to be.
Mm-hmm. But you're still, and in fact, I brought up the court has a view on all of this and what is recording. We have a report. Chief Judge is making the record committee. What does it mean to be recording? And we record in a variety of ways. We record and make a record. Recorded, a tape recording, a digital recording, and of course the stenographic recording, which has been our mainstay, which is reduced then to a transcript. But this report, which is now rather dated, says 52, the mainstay, 52% have used some kind of digital or tape recording and not just the stenographic written. So
certainly the practice in federal court nowadays has much more than 52% of proceedings recorded without a stenographic report.
So I think that the language recorded or unrecorded causes problems.
Mr. Schreiner.
Yes, Your Honor.
The rule as it stands now makes a distinction between a writing on one hand and a recorded statement on the other. Is there, as I'm listening to the conversation this morning, is it possible that striking writing from that rule introduces ambiguity because now we're not making a distinction between the two? relying on the reader inferring that a recorded statement includes something written.
I think we are. I think you're right.
Would it be possible in to capture the entire the entire universe of material that you want in this without without creating some potential ambiguity? Would it be possible to say when any part of a writing or recorded or unrecorded statement?
Of course, that suggests that a writing is something other than a recorded statement.
It does.
I think our thought, which may be flawed, is that between recorded and unrecorded, we've covered everything.
Yeah. Well, and I think you have. I mean, I see the evidence of Occam's razor at work in this amendment, and I always appreciate that. But sometimes Occam can cut a little too close to the bone.
Is that a premise of law or an assertion of fact?
That's an assertion of fact.
Okay.
If I may, I'll turn to 90608. The proposal here is simply to adopt a change that the federal system has already adopted a few years ago, in which it has, to kind of anticipate 90617 in some respects, replaced the word credibility, specific instances of the conduct of a witness for the purpose of attacking or supporting the witness's credibility. It's been changed to character for truthfulness, since there are so many other things that go to credibility. So since this is an exclusionary rule in the sense that it only allows, in that it bars the use of extrinsic evidence, when we get down to the meat of the sentence at the end, may not be proved by extrinsic evidence. What we're really trying to do here is limit the barring of extrinsic evidence to character for truthfulness, that is, in one's reputation as a truth teller or not, because there are so many other things, as I say, sort of adverted to in proposed 90617, which go to credibility, which ought to be allowed open season in cross-examination and otherwise testing the credibility of a witness.
Well,
90609.
Wait, let's stay on 90608 for a minute.
Yes, Your Honor.
The note makes reference to the 2003 Advisory Committee note to Rule 608B are instructive, though not binding. Well, that's true of any.
Right.
Any note. But phrasing it that way tends to think maybe all the others are binding. In understanding the scope and purpose, now it's in page 8 of your petition. Again, I'd have to go and find the 2003 Advisory Committee note to Rule 608B. If it's instructive, let's put it in so you make my life easier. Not difficult in having to go find it. And I am not only a lawyer, I am a non-lawyer who deals with this stuff.
I get your point, and I couldn't begin to argue with it. I'll just tell you what goes through our mind when we do that. We're working right now on a proposal, which we'll bring to the court eventually, to adopt the federal class action rule as it currently exists for Wisconsin. And we've thought about including some of the
federal... something like that's been filed, but go ahead.
We've thought about... I didn't hear
not
that.
Yet? Okay.
We've thought about including some of the Federal Advisory Committee notes on the class action.
Yep.
They are pages and pages.
I know,
and pages,
but if you look at 59 with second,
right,
you'll see pages and pages.
Right.
If you look at, we just adopted something quite recently, it may be electronic filing, but it may be something else, pages and pages of the federal rules and Wisconsin comments, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, if I have to have a choice of whether I have it in front of me in one book or I have a short form and I got to go to six books, I'll take the one book long.
I get it, Your Honor. And we just look to be led by the court on that. If that's what you want, that's what you'll get, I think. And similarly, if I may, on a point that came up when the South was up here about what should be the effective date. I think the rule of any change of a rule of procedure or evidence that says it will apply to pending cases unless in a particular case the trial judge decides that it might work in justice not to apply it is a good rule. That was the rule in 59 with second when the rules of evidence were, or rules of evidence were first adopted. When we were recently here on the uniform interstate deposition and discovery rule, that was a part of the rule. I think it's a good rule, and if that is the court's sense, I think we can generally include that in our rule petition.
You have nothing here about either effective date, but that's a standard and should be put in anyway, because maybe you want it later than January 1. I don't even know when this has to be adopted to be effective January 1. I have another question. Your second paragraph in your notes says 90609 and 90610 use the word credibility when the intent of these rules is to regulate impeachment of the witness's character for truthfulness. But you didn't change credibility to character for truthfulness in these other statutes. And then you say, no inference should be derived from the fact that the committee proposed an amendment of the term credibility here, but not elsewhere. Why not? Why can't you change everything to character for truthfulness?
I know what you're talking about, and I can't remember.
It's page 3 of your petition on your judicial counsel.
Well, you can simply compare 90608 and 90609. 90609's got credibility in it, too. But that didn't get changed. But 90608 sub 2, there's
but
a change.
90609, I think, uses credibility properly. It uses it in the broader sense.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, 90609 is all about what Wisconsin has decided a long time ago. That is, people who've been convicted of a crime are inherently less credible.
No, but your first sentence doesn't say that, Mr. Schreiner. That's why I'm concerned. Your first sentence is 90609 will also use the term credibility when the intent of those rules is to regulate impeachment of the witness's character for truthfulness. And that's what 90608 do. If this second paragraph said, uses the term credibility in a broader sense to include truthfulness and other, and then you have to tell me what the other is, then I would understand it. But you have three, it seems to me, or four inconsistent sentences here. Inconsistent. It says 90609 uses credibility for truthfulness, and the fact that you didn't change credibility to truthfulness, don't infer anything from it. So if you're going to define credibility broader in 90609 and 90610, okay, but what does credibility mean other than believability? Is that what it means? And it's believable if it's truthful.
No, I think that 90609 really means credibility in the broader sense. It doesn't mean reputation for truthfulness.
90608 isn't...
90608 is directed to the specific limitation on how far you can go in calling a witness to testify that this person has a good reputation.
Okay.
And it isn't meant to open up the whole thing. 90609, what we have attempted to do here is to embody in a rule for the first time the practice in Wisconsin's courts with respect to this issue.
Right. This is the number of convictions.
Number of convictions.
My husband was on jury duty one time, was called, and they said to him, they asked the jury, would you be... influenced, I don't know precisely what word they use, but influenced by the fact that a person was convicted of a crime. He was reporting this to me on the telephone. I was out of town. And he said, you know, I raised my hand, and I said, well, if it was perjury, I would. struck you? And he said, yeah, how'd you know? Well, I read in your memo that there was a big discussion of whether you should just limit it to truthfulness.
What it comes down to, if I may be brutally honest, as I know you want me to be, is shall
we'll
we change
honest,
the,
brutal, I can
yeah,
do that.
Shall we change the practice in Wisconsin courts? There's one big difference. A lot of big differences, but there's one big difference between the criminal practice in our courts and the criminal practice in the federal courts. We're overwhelmed with it. We've got cases being tried every day, and the federal courts get a criminal trial, you know, once in a blue moon.
Well, that's because they all plead.
That's because they have a lot of money and they have fewer cases, and they've got everything else going for them. My viewpoint, this is just me. The rule that we have in Wisconsin, however we got to it, where we just say number how many convictions, and the judge now authorized the witness to say what the judge determines instead of telling the witness to lie, as it is under the current rule, we've just used that as a shorthand way, and it really is based on the premise, which one might question, that every conviction of a crime makes a person less credible.
Credible
we're living with
not
a practice.
Truthful?
Please?
Credible meaning not truthful?
Not truthful.
Then why don't you
well,
use...
not, you know, you should have reason to question his testimony or her testimony. And the criteria which we have now suggested be embodied in 90609.2, in which a judge is enjoined to look at and assess in deciding what that number should be, include such things as what was the character of the crime. Is it one that involved perjury, fraud, something of that sort, as opposed to other matters that perhaps don't go to credibility? The lapse of time since the conviction. I had a civil case one time where in federal court, so we talked about whether to put it in or not by a specific case, where the testimony was 30, where the conviction was 30-some years before. And there's a presumption in the federal practice that that's just too old and told, and it doesn't go in. I don't know that that is the case in Wisconsin. Certainly the case in 2004 where everybody wrote criminal case in this court from which we have drawn from both the majority opinion
Gary M.B.
Yeah, your dissent and Justice Sykes' dissent and the majority opinion of the court for Justice Crooks all kind of agreed that's the premise in Wisconsin. So what we've tried to do is make this rule reflect one of the things we try to do. We think about not only non-lawyers but lawyers who may be not in court frequently who ought to be able to open the book and see what am I supposed to do. And I think the rule we propose is consistent with that premise, and it is not the federal rule. So this deviates now substantially from the text of Federal Rule 609, but in a way that reflects our practice.
Could I just verify something? You have no intent on affecting 90405 reputation or opinion evidence and character evidence under that rule, right?
Right.
Because this is the truthfulness.
This is truthfulness, right.
Okay.
And then 90616.
No, wait a minute. Where are you?
I was just jumping to the last one in 1602. I'm sorry.
Okay. I want to get an issue on 90608 we talked about. And then on 90609.2. The LRB has asked that you add words here. Are you familiar with that?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear the question.
I'm sorry. Let me just pull this over closer. Last sentence, there are two sentences. Factors for a court, right?
Yes.
Factors for a court to consider in evaluating whether to admit evidence of prior convictions for impeachment purposes include, and LRB asks that you add the words, all of the following. have any objection to that. Julie, do I have that right?
Well, all of the following, but only to the extent they're relevant in a particular case.
Well, that's why I'm asking you this question.
This was one of the concerns that, because this did get vetted, that we heard from the Council of Chief Judges, which is don't make a rule that you got to go through and talk about things that don't fit in a case.
Every single one of them. Now, and in that, I have a question about expungement. When I got to this at the bottom of the page, I said expungement, double underlined. And then when I got to your notes, it says sub 2 does not include expungement because evidence of a conviction expunged under 973.015 is not admissible under this rule, citing Anderson. And that goes back to the same concept. You know, if it's not there, people are going to forget it. And then you're going to get an expunged case, and then there's going to be a dispute, and then we have to go to another statute. So it seems to me it's just easier to put it in here rather than have to look aside. And I don't know whether there are any others that are floating around that you're excluding or including.
Well, I just think that what we're saying there is we don't want to get into expungement because an expungement isn't a conviction, and that's consistent with Anderson.
Yeah, well, we have cases where it may not be a conviction, but you can look at it anyway. So that's a problem. In fact, we've got a case pending right now.
State versus Howe is before the court, which deals with expunction. I don't necessarily agree with my colleague's position that you put the kitchen sink in. I think sometimes it makes the rule more burdensome than helpful.
Well, the sink isn't part of this, but expungement is, and you recognize it under two. Now, you can answer me, which is true. Well, you got it in the note, so it's right there in front of you. Just continue on in the note, and you'll find it. And so that's better than the other where it's nowhere that I can find. So I agree with that kind of concept of at least getting it into the note. But I have also found in recent rules petitions in the court that we've got a lot of things in comments and notes that don't appear in the text. And so what you really have to look at is forget the text. Just read the notes.
Well, the notes are, but of course, definitionally, the notes are intended to be helpful and not authoritative, so.
Right. Anyway. I know, so you pull it.
Right.
That's why I probably would put it in. But I'm thankful that at least it's in the notes.
The questions of my colleague to my left make me think that it might be wise to have the practice sort of somehow inserted in here, and the practice is that a judge decides what convictions are relevant and the number. It isn't, I mean, sometimes it's a lie. Sometimes someone has been convicted 10 times,
right,
but the judge only lets 6 of them in. If that practice were injected in here, then that would eliminate the concern about an expunged conviction, because something that has been expunged, the judge would not allow in.
But there has to be, under sub 3, Your Honor, the judge has to get involved, because you don't get to 2 until you've gone to 3.
So then it's not a concern?
Yeah, I think it is not.
Okay.
The whole point is to give judges discretion here.
The point is to give the judges discretion and to tell them things that they should think about.
Right, using their discretion. That's why you got the lapse of time, rehabilitation, gravity, dishonesty.
You know, if the number doesn't go to 0, I'm not sure what difference it makes, frankly. If you go from 6 to 4, what's the jury's reaction to that? But if it goes from 3 to 0 because they're old and irrelevant and have nothing to do with credibility, and the judge decides to keep them out, it probably makes a difference. Maybe it means the defendant takes a stand.
Have you heard the ad, 6 is more? more than four on TV?
No.
Well, there is one, so that's what the jury thinks. Six is more than four.
Counsel, I want to return to sub two exclusions.
Yes.
As I recall the history of this, your initial petition did not include, quote, all of the following, that the court should consider all of the following, but the LRB wrote that in and you went along with it. Is that right, or am I wrong on that?
I think
that?
We've, unless I'm missing something, we don't have all of the following now. Don't we?
No,
have?
But they added it afterwards, I think.
Okay.
You know, they look at this afterwards and then they add
yes.
and subtract.
And so it is my, and I understood that it was suggested by the LRB after the petition was filed and that the Judicial Council accepted the LRB's suggestion with regard to the language include all the following. I want you to fight harder and not accept it. But it seems to me that when you say factors for a court to consider include all of the following is just a problem.
I agree.
And so
I don't know why it's needed, but yeah. I didn't do the negotiating with LRB,
so I
take your point.
Okay.
If you do put in all the following as relevant,
that's the sense, certainly.
That's right.
It's as relevant.
Okay. I have another question about, are you up to 906093? Because there the LRB said you should change pursuant to under instead of pursuant to section 90104 under. I don't care. That one didn't bother me. Does it bother you? I mean, I just want to know what we're dealing with here.
To me, pursuant is more comfortable, but I don't know. I don't think they mean anything different. I don't think they're supposed to.
I don't think so either. I just...
Yeah.
If we're going to change some of your language, I just thought you ought to... We ought to put it on the table. We ought to have an opportunity to comment on it.
Well, my recollection is that Ms. Southwick always comes to the committee and tells us what the LRB wants to change. And she frequently says, well, we should change this, we shouldn't change that. And we normally go along with what she has to say, figuring she's got more experience dealing with them than we do. But I don't want you to think a lot of thought goes into the LRB's suggested drafting changes on the part of the committee. I'm sure the LRB has a lot of thought in it. It's in their book.
That's right. It's in. They do what's in the book. I understand.
The last in 1602 is the creation of a bias rule. And the question was asked whether this is independent of the dead man statute, and the answer is yes, clearly it is independent. 906.16 is one of the rules that from the beginning Professor Blinka suggested we adopt. It comes out of the Uniform Law Commission. It's been adopted in a couple of states. It's consistent with the case law in this state, and it seems to me it's a good rule. It's good to be able to point to a rule, again, someone coming in that says that evidence of bias, prejudice, or interest of a witness for or against any party is admissible. And then in our petition on the next page, Justice Abrahamson, there's a reference to the definition of bias from the Abel case, the U.S. Supreme Court's Abel case.
It's in the committee note, right?
It's in the committee note. It's a term used in the common law of evidence to describe the relationship between a party and a witness, which might lead the witness to slant, unconsciously or otherwise, his testimony in favor of or against a party. That is the law of Wisconsin already, I think. It would be helpful to have it in the statute, particularly, I think, if we're going to repeal the dead man statute, because... that is the concern that underlies the dead man statute, and indeed all of the common law limitations on competency, almost all of which have been swept down the halls of history.
So you have an expert witness who testifies, and one of the questions you ask is get the answers you think you should get, you can bring in extrinsic evidence so that this witness is always testifies for the railroad, always testifies for the auto industry, always testifies for plaintiffs. You can bring in extrinsic evidence on that. Bring in extrinsic evidence that most witnesses get paid X amount, but this guy gets X plus Y.
I always hear that when I'm in court, and I always wonder what the lawyers think when they're doing that, as if the jury didn't know the witness was getting paid. Of course, people don't show up as expert witnesses very often unless they're getting paid, and they often have a longstanding relationship with one side or the other. But maybe I give the jury too much credit for common sense.
Well, that's not the question. The question is...
Strike that answer.
Exactly. Be responsive. The question is, can you bring in that kind of extrinsic evidence? That's what I'm asking you, because that's what this says.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's what it's intended.
So that's the way to deal with the expert witness.
Okay.
Good. Thank you.
If I may, let me then turn to 1601. I was backwards in my numbering, which
is... Yeah, I'm sorry we didn't push you into doing dead man first, because the only people here are interested in dead man, and they're sitting patiently, and they would have gone home and billed hours.
I wanted an audience for what I was saying.
There you go. There you go. Would you please say
well,
what you have to say, because
we
are
the six of us. That would be
right.
We are running through our time, and I am going to assure they all get to speak before noon.
So
it's
just
now
speak.
11 o'clock or very close to.
I will finish in 10 minutes if I
thank you.
If I may.
Thank you.
Let me just, if I may, go to 885-205 first, just to push it aside. I think on this question of the court's power under 5112 to adopt rules of evidence and procedure and regulation of practice, 885, 16, and 17 are squarely within it. 885-205 is probably not. I'll just be frank with you. It's probably not. 885-205 was brought to our attention by somebody in the Legislative Reference Bureau who called our counsel and said, what's this? Can you guys do something about it? Maybe we should have pushed that off to somebody in the legislature, but there are aspects of it. First of all, it's titled privilege. It does not state a rule of privilege. It states a rule of confidentiality, but the caption is privilege. And it's in Chapter 885 called Witnesses and Oral Testimony. So people look at it and they think it's a privilege rule. I don't think it's a privilege rule. I think it's a terrible rule.
What's the difference?
Privilege is, as 501 tells us, privilege is the ability, the right of a witness not to testify. I think that's what it is.
And it can be waived?
Typically by the beneficiary of the privilege,
right,
and not by the witness. Yes, I mean, that's the general rule of privilege. We, by the way, just so you don't think we've ignored it, we still have under consideration in our committee the Alt rule, which we may or may not get to at some time, which is all about 90501 and whether the court can create new rules of privilege or whether it has or whatever. We're not talking about that today, but I won't try to defend 885-205 as something that this court ought to do by rule. It seems to me, however, it presents the opportunity for the court, if it wants it, to make the distinction between something like 885.205, which is a bad law, doesn't make any sense, it's dangerous, all of these things we've heard from the people who came to talk to us about it, who are supposedly the beneficiaries of it, but probably not within the court's authority to do, but we thought we'd run it up the flag. 885, 16, 17, on the other hand, clearly are. And it seems to me that from the fact that from the very beginning, this court has changed statutes in 1973, which were rules of competency and limitations on competency, is a good example of that. And it helps to think back to what the original common law rules of competency were. A criminal defendant couldn't testify on his own behalf in a criminal case because he was incompetent. The Funk case, the 1933 U.S. Supreme Court case that's discussed in our brief, was one where a defendant's wife was called to testify on his behalf in a prohibition trial, and she was barred from testifying because she was incompetent by reason of interest. This is a very bad body of law, and it's squarely within this court's authority to change it. The court didn't do it in 1973. It didn't make a record of why it didn't do it. Apparently, Chief Justice Wilkie wrote a letter to Reuben Peterson explaining that they decided they would let it go. I could call Reuben to testify, but he'd probably be barred by the dead man statute from telling about his conversations with Chief Justice Wilkie. I don't know.
Only if there was an objection.
Only if there was an objection, which gets to another thing. This court doesn't like the dead man statute. The first thing I ever heard about it when I did a probate case back in the early 70s, Harold McComas told me, got to make the objection in the right way. You can't object to the admission of the evidence. You could object to the competency of the witness to testify. And although the case law seems to go the other way, you better do it at the deposition too, you know, because it's a trap for the unwary. It's a malpractice trap for lawyers. That bothers me that we should have that. This court regulates the practice of law as well as it regulates the rules of procedure. It's a bad rule. When we considered this, we sent it out to everybody, including the State Bar. It has been, and we cite 2005 Wisconsin Court of Appeals case that sets it out, the Graychick case or something. It has been the longstanding position of the State Bar, at least since sometimes after 1973, to advocate for the repeal of the dead man statute, as the ABA, the Uniform Law Commissioners, the Federal Advisory Committee, all, it's bad law. I've been on the Board of Governors. I know how this works. This came to the Board of Governors recently, and they had a majority, as I understand it, to favor repeal, but not a supermajority as required under the bar rules. So there's nobody here speaking for the bar today one way or the other. Fortunately, we have some practitioners that will speak to the merits of why this is a bad rule, why it's a good rule, and I don't mean to address those. I just want to say, I think from the point of view of the rules of evidence, it's a bad rule. It's long past time for its revocation. It's within this court's power to revoke it. Whatever may have motivated the court in 73 not to jump into what was then a pitched battle between probate lawyers, probably wisdom, to stay out of it, I don't think is there anymore. There is no surge of pro-dead man statute interest in this state, and I think a bad rule that has just gotten worse in the intervening 43 years ought to be repealed, and you've got the authority to do it and ought to do it.
Thank you.
And this would be a perfect rule to apply to pending cases unless the trial judge thinks it would be unjust. If there are cases out there in which a dead man's statute is an issue, trial judge may well decide to let that case get resolved under the old rule. But going forward, we shouldn't have it anymore.
So you're asking, as you started earlier, that the effective date, which is set forth in 751-12
right.
of January 1 or July 1,
right.
be modified in this case?
Well, no, that the effective date, but that the court would say, as it has in these other instances, it will be effective, and it will apply. The question really is, does it apply just to future cases or pending cases?
Retroactive application, not effective.
It'll apply to pending cases, unless the trial judge, who's obviously in the best position to make a good judgment about that, the exercise of discretion, says, no, that wouldn't be fair in this case.
Thank you very much.
That's our submission.
I'm going to try to limit the other witnesses to 10 minutes apiece so that our presenters, if they hear something that's brought up they didn't have a chance to speak to, can kind of conclude it for us. Attorney Igrisano, if you'd like to go forward, please.
Good morning, Chief Justice. May it please the Court. Again, I'm Jonathan Igrisano of Godfrey & Kahn. I want to thank you for this opportunity. As a probate and trust litigator, the petition to repeal the dead man statute is an area of considerable professional and academic interest to me. Almost every probate and trust dispute that we see requires consideration of the dead man statute. And most require specific strategy and research on how to apply the statute or how to avoid it, depending on what our client's particular interest is in that case. I've objected to the testimony under the dead man statute. I've argued that the dead man statute should be overruled and deemed waived, sometimes in the same case. Now I join in asking this court to repeal these statutes. My colleague Jonathan Sneeze and I previously submitted a comment in support of the petition. While thanking the judicial counsel for his good work, we set forth three practical concerns of the dead man statute. The first was the expected surge in probate and trust litigation, which we believe means will result in increased reliance on the dead man statute.
Can I ask you a question about
that? Yes.
Many, many, many years ago, we did an empirical study of across the state of probate files, trust files, to see how many disputes there were, what litigation, and it was almost none. So, what's the situation now? I mean, if I went to the Dane County Court and I pulled out at random 15 pending probate cases, 20, how many of them would have litigation pending?
I would like to see an empirical study done more recently. I have not.
We found less than 1%. I mean, it was almost zero, whether you were in North Woods or in Milwaukee or in Dane County or anywhere else.
And what we did in our comment was we took the pulse from the professional advisors, money managers, corporate fiduciaries, people that are looking at trying to deal with this surge. And what we saw was that there's a recognized theme known as the Great Transfer that began in 2007 and is going to continue and peak. And we
that
see
because of the estate tax.
It's mostly a generational issue,
that's what I'm
Justice. It's mostly because of, as the baby boomers and the silent generation begin passing away, you're going to see statistically there should be a huge uptick in the amount of wealth transfers.
And the increased wealth from inflation and the market going up, you know, you'd get to 5 million faster.
More transfers and as we also cited, more incidents of Alzheimer's, we believe, is going to result in more probate and trust litigation. And that's going to exacerbate what we believe is the problem with these statutes. Second was the issue of litigation expense. And we believe that it's an unwieldy rule. The scope limitations and the waiver doctrines result in substantial research and motion practice for our clients. Going to Justice Kelly's concern stated earlier, we've also believed that the proposed repeal and proposed bias rule will also limit appeals and make things more efficient. You're taking this away from a legal issue. You're putting all the cards on the table and allowing an assessment of the evidence. Like in every other situation involving an interested witness, credibility determinations are being left to the fact finder in those cases, which
by
we
credibility,
have
no credibility, do you mean truthfulness?
I'm sorry?
By credibility, do you mean truthfulness?
Yes, and that's why we believe a lot of the
well, there are other ways of being credible or not credible. Maybe you didn't, maybe you weren't there when something was said. Maybe you weren't there when something occurred, so you didn't see it, and your relation is more guesstimation based on what the results you saw were rather than on the actual accident. So I think that credibility is not just whether someone's being telling the truth or not, correct?
That's true. The idea, though, behind the dead man statute is this idea that, and the court said it in 1962, the court identified the purpose of the dead man statute in In re Kemmerer. The reason for the statute is the belief that it is the better public policy to protect the estate from possible fraudulent claims. The idea is that the statute pits the living against the dead, and the dead are not there to protect themselves. One of our points that we want to expand on here this morning is that in actuality, perhaps cynically, it's actually the living versus the living, and not so much the idea of protecting the estate. Because what we see, Your Honors, is that the dead man statute is not as noble as it pretends to be on its face. It's instead a tool for the living to be used to either attack or defend the claim of another living beneficiary of an estate, used to support or undermine competing claims between competing heirs and competing beneficiaries. We see this often, that the dead man statute is used to thwart claims challenging the expressed intent of the testator or the grantor. It necessarily solidifies one party's claims while undermining the other. Undue influence is a classic example. The dead man statute is used to bar statements by the deceased, conveying his or her susceptibility to undue influence, conveying the influencer's coveted result, or the influencer's disposition to influence. We see it barring evidence in cases of duress, or where there's an ambiguous will or trust, and the testator or grantor may have made statements about what his or her true intent was. But much more so than what you would think from the terms of the Dead Man Statute, we also see the Dead Man Statute being used to thwart defenses to claims related to a decedent's intent. In essence, the Dead Man Statute is used as a sword and not just as a shield. The Dead Man Statute in many jurisdictions has been interpreted to limit an interested person's from refuting allegations of undue influence. A quick search would reveal cases from the Supreme Courts of Missouri, Michigan, and Iowa, to name a few, where they have held that a person accused of undue influence is barred from making statements of what the decedent told him or her about that. It's an instrument that, and this is all because an instrument like a trust, like a will, presumptively reflects the deceased person's intent, and the alleged influencer is presumptively the person that the deceased intended to benefit. So rather than protecting the estate, which is the stated purpose of the Dead Man Statute, you see that the deceased's preferred beneficiary is handcuffed from the ability to defend him or herself from very serious allegations.
When you have a document like a will or a trust, which is supposed to cover everything, how do you get to talking about stuff outside the written document?
Sure. If it's a question of the intent behind the four corners of the document, a trust, a will, is no different than a contract, and you've got an unambiguous will or trust.
And you got a parole evidence rule.
Yes, but where there's ambiguity, that may be where...
Isn't there always?
Not always.
Not when they're drafted having by you.
having moved for summary judgment on trusts and wills and contracts, I would argue that there is not always ambiguity, Your Honor. But it also, too, it's important to recognize that it prevents testimony in support of defenses from interested fiduciaries. As I mentioned in our letter, smaller estates with less sophisticated individuals tend to have beneficiaries wear two hats. It's fiduciary and beneficiary. And oftentimes they're accused of wrongdoing. And oftentimes the best evidence of their consent, the ratification, the good faith is through the statements that this close person had with the decedent. I would also want to point out that it's going to be an issue with elder abuse cases, because the Dead Man Statute applies to the incompetent. That is how we've interpreted insane, the insane prong of the Dead Man Statute. So we're going to have folks that are going to be accused of elder abuse in the next 20 to 30 years, and the question of whether they're going to be able to use self-interested statements in support of their defenses or of their claims is certainly an issue.
So that you're saying this applies if they're alive but incompetent?
Yes, under Whitney versus Traynor, which is an 1889 case, that's where we extended...
Those cases are already... You watch TV.
I'm sorry?
There's an ad for our lawyers saying if your mother or father is in a nursing home and has been subject to physical abuse or financial exploitation, call us.
That is not my practice area, but I will advise Your Honor that I get calls on that frequently. Do you do this kind of work, whether as a plaintiff's counsel or as a defense counsel? Just as I expect trust and estates litigation to increase, I expect elder abuse litigation to increase as well. Yep. It's going to have the exact same problems that we're seeing here.
There are even elder courts being established to handle this.
Yes. Your Honors, an estate or a trust is to be distributed in accordance with the deceased's intent. We believe the Dead Man Statute does not help to uncover and effectuate that intent. If a deceased's oral statements are relevant and otherwise admissible on an issue of his or her intent, the determination of that intent is not furthered by barring the testimony of witnesses often closest to the deceased. The Dead Man Statute acts to obscure intent, not to protect it. Applying the Dead Man Statute is not always consistent with the decedent's interest, but it is always consistent with at least one living person's interest, the person who is asserting the Dead Man Statute in that case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney Smees, are you going to make some comments also? Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is John Smees. I'm also from the law firm of Godfrey & Kahn. I appreciate the opportunity to present to your honors this morning. Our position is that the Wisconsin court's narrowing of the statute's application is not an adequate substitute for repeal. The statutes are obviously disfavored. We see that in commentary from the court through the decades, with the state bar opposing or proposing repeal very early on, as early as 1940. And what's resulted from that, as Justice Abramson noted, was we have sort of partially destroyed the effect of the statute. The statute is still there. It's a hollowed-out version of itself with many different aspects that the practitioner must be mindful of. And it's our contention that this may be a case in which the cure is worse than the disease, so to speak, that this attempt to limit the scope of the statute has resulted in a lot of uncertainty for practitioners, as Mr. Attorney Schreiner noted, who have to be mindful of many things when confronted with the statute. I'd like to talk of two ways in which the courts have attempted to limit the impact of the statute. One would be the scope in terms of what is an interested person for the statute, and also issues relating to the proper formulation of an objection and resulting waiver. So, with regard to the interest of a person under the statute, the test as formulated is whether the witness will gain or lose by the direct operation and effect of the judgment. Now, that's really come down to be interpreted to be something which requires a subjective remoteness test. And courts then are asked to decide whether this interest is present, certain, and vested, not just a remote or contingent interest. This leaves a bit to be desired in the practice in trying to determine what exactly will be a sufficiently direct or not remote interest in a matter for a witness to be deemed competent to testify. And there are examples in the case law that are all over the map in terms of when a witness is interested or not under the statute. In one case, the estate of Nail, at 61 with second 654, there was a claimant on the estate who provided housekeeping services to the deceased, and at one point she, the claimant, overheard the deceased speaking to neighbors, third parties, who were also deceased at the time, as it turned out, about the deceased's promise to her to pay her for housekeeping services. In that case, the court permitted this claimant to provide that testimony because the comments were not made directly to her. So a very strange and artificial line was drawn in that case. And interestingly also in that case, the claimant's own daughter was permitted to provide testimony concerning the statements of the decedent, given the fact the daughter, even though likely an heir of the claimant, did not have her interest was sufficiently remote. So that she was not interested for purposes of the statute. So
that issue is going to come up on the language on bias motive that's been adopted. Is it remote enough to be biased?
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. So it will be something, I guess, maybe that will continue in at least some aspect, but at least within the overall
at least you won't have to deal with this statute.
That's correct.
Deal with a different statute.
That's right. And I'll get to that later in terms of the formulation of the objection and so how harsh that can be. There are other examples of the sort of conundrum that can result from the application of this interest test. In one case, this is Gerzak versus Gerzak. It's a 2005 Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision, I believe Attorney Schreiner mentioned earlier. The court had to decide whether or not the spouse of a claimant was sufficiently interested, depending on the nature of the property interest at stake. The issue in that case was whether this was a family business. The owner of the company passed away. The son had worked for a number of years, apparently without pay. Essentially, he, in his mind, he thought it was loans to this company to keep it running. The issue in that case was, are these unpaid wages, which would be barred under a two-year statute limitation, or are they loans to the company, in which case their loans arguably would be a claim against the estate. So the claimant's spouse wanted to provide testimony that these are indeed loans to her husband from the company, which would be permissible, it would allow for recovery. And the court concluded that this is marital property, therefore she has an interest in this dispute and is not competent to testify. And it raises a very strange specter here, that the application of a statute designed to eliminate perjury rests on the fiction that a spouse won't shade or falsify testimony when the interested person stands to gain something other than marital property. So if it had been some other type of property he may have had an interest in, she could testify to that, but since in this particular instance under the Marital Property Act, a loan would be, you know, marital property, and under that set of conditions, she's not competent to testify. So it is a bit of a minefield out there. For each of these scenarios, there's costly litigation with uncertain results. In each case, a witness on one side will be permitted to give suspect testimony, while the interested witnesses on the other side will be prohibited from rebutting that testimony himself or herself. So while the interest concept is one that's fraught with problems for the practitioner, so too is the formulation of the objection in the proper form. And here we see a talismanic reliance on the use of the words competency. One must, to properly preserve the objection, incant the right words at the right time in the right manner. It is a minefield for the practitioner in that regard. There are examples where objections made on the basis of immateriality, irrelevance, or a general transactions with the deceased objection will be insufficient, given the strict interpretation which this court places on the dead man's statute. Such shorthand objections are insufficient to bring into question the competency of the witness. There are decisions along these lines going back at least to the late 19th century in which parties that didn't preserve their objection sufficiently were precluded from raising the statute. And the consequences for failure to raise this in the right way at the right time are dramatic. It can result in a waiver. As this court said in In Re Mole's estate in 1970, a party waives the protection of the statute by failing to make the proper objection, which is to the competency of the witness to testify, not to the testimony. An objection to the evidence, or one which is vague and does not specifically mention the incompetency of the witness, is not considered a proper objection. There is even one example of a case from the Court of Appeals, Mielke versus Nording. This is from 1983, in which there was actually a citation to the statute itself, the dead man's statute, in making the objection, but because it wasn't to competency, that was not sufficient to preserve the objection. So, as Justice Abramson noted in speaking with Attorney Schreiner on Petition 1602, there's an instance in which, in that case, one couldn't just look at the rule to determine what it means in practice. I think that's what we have here with the dead man statutes as they now are on the books. There's an obvious distaste for them by many, many commentators, the courts through the years. That's resulted in an understandable desire to avoid their effect, but it's left the practitioner with many difficult situations trying to ascertain when these statutes will apply and when they will not. And it's our contention that this uncertainty this creates in practice is in no one's interest, and for that reason, we recommend repeal.
Attorney Smees, are either you or Attorney Ingrassano members of the probate section of the State Bar?
I am not, Your Honor. I can't speak for my colleague on that point, but
I will not count myself, Your Honor, an inactive member of the session. I was not formally a member, but I have not participated.
Okay, so neither of you would know why the probate section hasn't weighed in on this proposed
report. We have someone from the state bar here. Maybe he can tell us when he gets up to bat.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And having so said, Mr. Goldman, can you give us a little more information?
Yes, thank you, Chief Justice Roggensack, and to the other members of the court. I will address some of your concerns in my points. I'll try to keep it brief and on point. I give a little bit of background to set the table. My name is Jeff Goldman. I'm a partner at DeWitt Ross & Stevens, just next door here. I'm also a state and trust litigator, like my colleagues here. I'm an adjunct professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, teaching a class entitled Estate and Trust Administration and Dispute Resolution.
Oh, you can do an empirical study for us then. I'll tell you how to do it later.
And in addition, for a little bit of perspective, I've practiced law in Wisconsin for the last 10 years. Prior to that, my first 2 years out of law school, I practiced in Washington State, which has a dead man statute. The next 2 years, I practiced in New York State, which has a dead man statute. So coincidentally, I've practiced in the three states I've practiced are three of the 13 that have a dead man statute. And so it gives me a little bit of perspective, and which is where my comments at the State Bar Board of Governors level came from. And my interest here, before I get to my substantive comments, is not to advocate for the dead man statute. I'm not here to say we should keep the dead man statute. That's what I want. At the same time, I'm also not advocating necessarily for this rule, but rather I'm presenting issues that I see or that I perceived and that I felt were necessary to make you aware of and to be addressed. So with regard to the Board of Governors meeting, this issue did come up at the last two Board of Governors meetings, or at least it was included in the materials, and I noticed it because it was part of my practice and it was something of interest to me. I also, as part of my role in the Board of Governors, am the liaison to the Real Estate Probate and Practice Trust section. I am a member of that section, but my real participation in that section is as the liaison to the Board of Governors.
What does a liaison do?
I'm sorry?
What does a liaison do?
Basically, I attend the meetings of the board of the RPPT section, and my job is to essentially represent the Board of Governors and some of its interests there, and to report back to some of the things that I see there.
Do they still put out they used to put out a written publication, a newsletter or something. Do they still do that?
That has, in my experience, up until very recently, that has not been the case. It had been discontinued, but it has been picked back up by certain members of the board, and I believe there's been one volume that's come out, and that is intended to continue.
Mm-hmm. Does it say anything about this subject?
It does not. Okay. And one of the points I wanted to make before making my substantive points was, from the RPPT perspective, I was the one who brought it to the group's attention, having seen it in some of the Board of Governors materials. And there is interest there, but one of the dynamics, I would say, now whether it's of coincidence or of evolution, I'm not sure, but I would have to characterize that most of the people on the RPPT board are more on the transactional, the planning side, as opposed to the litigation side. I do both in my practice. I do actively litigate estate and trust dispute cases. I also draft trusts, wills, that sort of thing. So I'm a little bit of an oddity now, at least in terms of maybe the larger firm practice.
Yeah, except that you're not a very good planner if you don't know what it's like in litigation and what are the issues that will come up in litigation.
I would agree with that, Justice Aberson. I would.
Having worked in this area for a long time.
I think that does give me a perspective in my own planning practice to see what issues do come up in litigation. I think that's a very valid point. In terms of the comments that I had to the bar and some of the thoughts that I had and wanted to share, they can basically be broken down into two groups, policy and practice. The other speakers have touched on the policies. I don't want to rehash that or restate that, but there's a tension between this new proposal and what exists now. What exists now is somewhat could be characterized as a preference towards the deceased person. In other words, if the deceased person can't testify about this, then the person who is still alive and on the other side of this conversation, this transaction shouldn't be able to either. Whether you buy that or not, that's what's offered. And on the other side, the new idea, I think the policy is that what we have is it's a better policy overall to leave it to the fact finder. The fact finder is capable of making these decisions. It does it in other areas. So that's what we should do. And that by doing so, you wouldn't limit or hold back honest claims of honest claimants that may come forward. But one thing I wanted to point out is that the dead man statute, of course, doesn't exist in a vacuum. And in the other areas of estate and trust law, both common law and in the statutory scheme, there are preferences towards the deceased, if you will. One that comes to mind is Wisconsin has an interesting position in that the right to make a will in Wisconsin is considered a constitutional or a quasi-constitutional right. You don't see that everywhere. That is a Wisconsin tradition. Secondly, the common law doctrines that really apply to most estate and trust disputes, your testamentary capacity, your undue influence. And there's also a bunch of presumptions that could apply in these situations. Presumption of the validity of the will, presumption of the capacity of the testator. And then the evidentiary burden that a contestant has to meet in order to show that someone lacked capacity or show that the will or the document was the product of undue influence is a heightened, clear and convincing evidentiary burden. And last, even in the newest trust code, which was just went into effect last January or July 1st of 2014, even there, the drafting committee, I was not on the drafting committee, but I've attended a lot of the legal education topics and have been very interested in contact with some of the drafting committee members. And that law did not adopt the Uniform Trust Code completely. Okay.
Did we adopt the restatement of a trust third?
We did not. And in fact, and I was actually just getting to that point, and in fact, members of the drafting committee have said that, in fact, our law, as evolved into the new trust code, actually tips more towards restatement second. What's the effect there? The real difference, and there's a wealth of scholarly writing on that, is that restatement third and the full uniform trust code tends to favor the interest of the beneficiaries, their property rights as beneficiaries, whereas restatement second, and quite frankly the common law of Wisconsin, favors fairly heavily the settlor's rights, dead hand control, if you will. Okay, so I think that when looking at the dead man statute, I think it's necessary to understand this background and this backdrop. And I say that without advocating the dead man statute, but
well,
by just
where does it
recognizing
get you?
It.
Where does it get you? I mean, I think this is a very good summary of the balance of the policies. But where does it get you on the dead man statute?
Well, and this may be an unsatisfactory answer, Your Honor. I'm not here to say this is what I want. I'm honestly undecided.
That's good enough. I just want to know where you are, and I want you to know, want to know what you think our court should do. Our courts are either adopted, don't adopt it. I can point to many rules petitions still pending where obviously the court, for one reason or other, doesn't reach a decision. So what should we do? Adopt it? That is, adopt repeal, leave it alone, or hold it?
Right. And that's why you're sitting in that chair. I guess my comments are intended, and as I said,
that's
it may
good.
Be unsatisfactory, but to lay out some of these thoughts and the tension.
Yeah.
And that's to my next point is the practice.
Mm-hmm.
Attorney Ingrisano and Smee's letter, I think, identified a valid point, and one that's thrown out a lot, is that by getting rid of the dead man statute, we can reduce costs. Okay, we can reduce litigation at the court level, we can reduce fees at the client level, and maybe even reduce burdens or barriers to litigants who might not be affluent or not have the means, or maybe the estate just doesn't have the amount of money at stake to make it worth
mm-hmm.
litigating.
That's access to justice in our lingo.
Yes, Your Honor. And I see that, and I recognize that as a possibility, but the other side, the flip side of that to me is, well, what are we replacing this with? Okay, and what's the dynamic and what's the practice then? And I think Justice Kelly made a comment earlier that kind of touched on that. And so to me, as a litigator, I think, okay, if I'm not now litigating or doing discovery or filing motions about the dead man statute, I have a bias statute. Am I not going to be doing discovery about bias? Am I not going to be arguing to the court about bias? So on balance, maybe there's a net gain in savings. Maybe it's, yes, there's going to be some litigation on those points, but on balance, it's a better system to not have the dead man statute, but I just don't know, and I see it kind of both ways. And another aspect that's very similar to that is one of the rationales of getting rid of the dead man statute is that that would keep us from barring honest claimants from bringing claims. And I believe Attorney Ingrassano and Smith's letter also spoke to that in terms of the access to justice, in that a more sophisticated estate plan may not have as many ambiguities or problems that a more simple estate plan does. But to me, that goes against their efficiency argument, because then if what we're doing is we're going to now allow in these honest claims, does that not mean we now have dishonest claims and honest claims? Do we now have more claims to litigate as opposed to a smaller group? In other words, so in the interest of efficiency of not arguing over the dead man statute, do we now have an influx of cases that are litigated at the trial court level that never would have been before? And with that, I'll conclude.
So you think there's an increase in litigation?
Possibly. I mean, I think that, you know, if the idea is that the dead man statute is negative from a policy perspective because, you know, although it may keep out fraudulent claims, it's keeping out honest claims. Well, then if we don't have a dead man statute, by association, we're now allowing in these honest claims, which, as I'm sure you all have known in your practice and before the court, there's not many litigants who think of their claim as dishonest when they bring it. And so I think as a group for the court and as a policy issue, one of the questions is, are we then having more of these estate disputes because there isn't this bar to be a deterrent?
Thank you, counsel. I don't know, do you have anything you want to add, Mr. Schreiner or Attorney Southwick? Neither one of you. All right, very good. Thank you very much. And thank you all for those who support it. And thank you, Attorney Goldman, for giving us the perspective of someone who just shakes his head and is not sure if it's going to be better or worse without it than it is with it. So we appreciate it. That concludes our hearing. We will need an open conference at 1:30 to discuss this and some other matters that are on our agenda. So we are adjourned.